Have you ever participated in a citizen science project? Maybe it was related to coral reefs or recycling programs. Maybe it was frog calls or bird watching. Amazing work. Thank you for your service. But, I mean, they're pretty terrestrial, you know? What if you could be part of a citizen science program in space? I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Occam's Razor, a soapbox for science. Today's speaker studies space junk, and she wants your help. Here's Mars Butfield Addison.
So, you know that feeling of relief when you're somewhere remote and you end up having mobile phone reception? Or you get an early enough warning about an extreme weather event that you can prepare your home and garden, or you get on a plane and you can be reasonably confident that that aircraft is going to end up landing where you expect it to. You can thank satellites for all these things. In fact, we're becoming more and more reliant on space-based infrastructure throughout our daily lives. But space debris threatens to put all of this at risk. Objects in orbit travel up to tens of thousands of kilometres an hour, which means even a very small fragment could completely obliterate even a large satellite if they were to collide. The technologies that we're developing to remove debris from orbit are decades away from reaching a level of maturity. Over the next few years, private companies propose to launch as many new satellites as there have been total number of satellites ever, which means given the amount of debris that's already up there and the amount that we're likely to generate over the next few years, space debris is going nowhere fast. And we need to think about more creative solutions that don't just focus on prevention or cleanup. And so coverage of this issue has largely focused on awareness alone. This gives you the impression that a regular citizen is powerless to fight against catastrophe in orbit. Awareness is really good for the policy issue. There are really smart people who work on enacting laws and regulations that will limit the number and types of things that are allowed to be launched into orbit, and that make sure that things don't end up being debris while they're still in orbit, and especially punish people who do really selfish or reckless things in orbit. But I argue that the general public does not only have awareness or advocacy to offer this issue. So the area that I work in is called space domain awareness, which just means knowing what's going on and what is around Earth in space. And a key part of having awareness of the space domain is space traffic control. And it sounds very similar to air traffic control, like there is at an airport, because it is. We have sensors all over the world that look at the skies, figure out what's there, see where it is, where it's going, and then make calculations, extrapolate that, see where they will be into the future. That's really important because that means we can send up alerts. So if it seems like two of those things are going to end up in the same place at some point, we get both parties on the phone, we tell them what their new trajectory is, and they figure out what the necessary maneuvers are to get those satellites onto those paths if possible. There are a lot of chaotic elements and largely random or poorly modeled elements that are introduced into these calculations. Lots and lots of things can impact how satellites orbit, everything from what the sun is doing flare-wise right now to the temperature of our upper orbit, upper atmosphere. And so very, very quickly, these calculations or predictions go out of date. So we just have to run them all again. We take more snapshots, we run our calculations over and over. We do this every day, 24/7, 365. With the rate at which new countries and companies propose to add new things to space, and then even more are achieving launch capability for the first time, and these new mega constellations where people propose to add in single swoops thousands or tens of thousands of new satellites, our current capabilities are falling behind. Building new radars or giant telescopes to observe and track things in space costs millions or billions of dollars each. They need to be built in quiet or dark regions away from population centers and then connected with really high throughput fiber connections to supercomputers that will do those calculations and then to the data repositories upon which decisions are made. This work is a huge undertaking, and so we're falling further and further behind. Many justify this using reasoning such as, well, it hasn't gone horribly wrong yet, so. Here's where my work fits in. I work on looking at ways that existing sensors, like radio telescopes built for astronomical observations or other atypical things, can be adapted to be used as space and satellite observing instruments. But this is only a partial solution. And as it stands, this kind of space tracking work is highly exclusive. For many decades, this was the domain of the militaries alone. Only recently has this expanded to include universities and a little bit of private enterprise. But that wasn't always the case. Actually, in the very start of the space race, so we get the late 1950s, early 60s, there was another case. The dedicated infrastructure to track things in space wasn't yet established. So when, in 1957, the then Soviet Union launched Sputnik, the first satellite ever put into space by man, the Soviets were still working on adapting space tracking instruments out of their existing ballistic missile test hardware. And the US had already spent about 2 years establishing this huge international network. It ran all the way down North and South America. There were had been multiple iterations of it by that point. They spent all this money. They made new treaties. But when it turned out to be targeting the wrong frequencies, it couldn't see Sputnik at all. So instead, for many months, both countries would rely on amateur radio and telescope operators armed with state training manuals who would look for satellites around the clock and call a dedicated phone line when they saw one. In the US, this effort was named Operation Moonwatch for optical, or Moonbeam for amateur radio detection. Volunteers were organized by local hobbyist clubs, and their coordinators were trained by scientists or even the government to ensure high quality. So could this happen again? Satellite tracking in the early space race is still one of the largest citizen science efforts ever recorded, or even attempted. But nowadays, people, regular people everywhere, are walking around mostly with really high-powered devices on their person. In this era, people have become pretty familiar with citizen science efforts, both passive and active. So yeah, maybe every person armed with an iPhone isn't going to go out there and track satellites, but a hobbyist stargazer with a telescope? Yes. An amateur radio operator? Sure. These guys take photos of satellites all the time. They post them on forums, they post them on Facebook, they nerd out about them, they're great. And I think this demographic is an untapped resource. A big problem of citizen science efforts is interest versus information. You have to minimize the expertise required of each participant, and you have to quickly administer the information required to the people who would be willing and interested to help. We've already seen this happen, not just in the early days of the space race, but also now. There's a worldwide hobbyist community called SatNOGS, who gather and disseminate information necessary for the establishment of citizen-led and operated global space tracking networks, including hardware and software designs. These are all open source, they're well documented, and they're ready and willing to help you. These don't have the sensitivity of the big military operated sensors in the national networks, but they do have the scalability. Virtually anyone in the world can join and get information about simple hardware procedures to join these networks. It's really cool. It's SatNOGS, and I highly recommend you look it up. Anyway, so if people are already organizing this way, then what am I up here shouting about it for? The other side of the equation is lacking. People can set up ground stations and collect information about satellite movements and behaviors, but they have nowhere to send it. The connection between data and decisions is via centrally controlled data repositories made up primarily of infrastructure controlled by the US Air Force and Space Command. Australia has its own Space Command and Space Agency now, and sovereign capabilities has been at the top of their list for several years. They're doing a great job. It's a real focus area for them. But these data formats and databases, even procedures for sharing information about satellites, has been in place for decades. And gee, if government isn't an immovable beast sometimes. So a few years ago, the US Space Force actually made this new system a shared data portal called the Unified Data Library, or UDL. This will finally allow the integration of disparate sources of satellite data in different formats to come together and be used as a single source for decision-making regarding orbital movements. But the criteria for becoming a data provider in the UDL are strict and consequently limit participation to defense forces, defense contractors, and the like. In data science, we have a saying, garbage in, garbage out. And this is to reflect that data of unverified quality will usually produce decisions or data products of unverified quality. However, in the more research that we put into things like big data and the training of artificial intelligence models, we're seeing more and more that for certain types of information gathering, this does not hold up. I mean, quality over quantity is not necessarily true. There's actually quite a lot of value that can be gained even from low-quality data if available in sufficient quantity, like something about the law of averages or such. Systems like the UDL already incorporate unverified data from companies and research institutions and government entities all over the world and use that information to make decisions. Protections are already in place to detect conflicting or infeasible information, and less dramatic errors can be found through correlation between multiple data sources. Why not allow contributions from a broader range of entities, from hobbyist groups or even the general public? Why not leverage the people's thirst to be able to improve something about the world through their own actions and to address one of the most pressing issues of our time? So a statement like the general public has a part to play in tracking satellites and ultimately the battle against space debris might sound pretty strange for me to get up here and tell you, but I do think that with the right policy and attitude changes, they could. Functionally, it would actually only require some minor changes to systems which already exist to integrate and adapt and verify different data sources. But I do know that this particular idea isn't like a shining silver bullet on its own, but it does give us an idea about how we need to be more creative when thinking about solutions to wicked problems like space debris. Like with other wicked problems like climate change, like social justice, like the digital divide, this isn't one of those things where the solution is going to come fully formed, emerging from a locked boardroom one day. I think we need to be more creative about how we get information, about how we look at space, about who has the rights to look at space and enact their agency over solutions regarding space, and about who can be involved. Thank you.
That was Mars Butfield Addison, computer scientist and PhD candidate at the University of Tasmania. She was speaking there at our Occam's Razor live show at Willie Smith's Apple Shed in the Huon Valley in Lutruwita, Tasmania. I'm Tegan Taylor, your Occam's Razor host, and this is our last Occam's Razor episode for the year. So thank you so much for listening. If you would like to continue to hear my voice over summer, please check out my other shows, What's That Rash and Quick Smart, both on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.